Campus FM presents a lecture by the CERN, the Institute for Research on the Science of the Times. Cults, sects, and new religious movements, what are they doing in contemporary Western society? The lecture is delivered by Professor Eileen Barker.
Ladies and gentlemen, sects and cults are not a new religious phenomenon. They've been with us for a long time in one form or another. However, in recent years, we've seen a resurgence and an emergence of a large number of sects, old or new. Almost all established Christian churches do see the emergence and rapid proliferation of this type of new religion or pseudo-religious movements, groups or practices, at least as a nuisance and at most as a threat. It is only in a few countries, predominantly Islamic ones, that there does not seem to be a widespread of this phenomenon. In some cases, the phenomenon appears even within mainline churches, especially in the form of sectarian attitudes. In most cases, they occur outside the churches or against, or often establish themselves on a similar spiritual patterns. The phenomenon develops fast and often quite successfully and can pose pastoral problems for the churches. The most immediate problem is that of knowing that one of your family has become involved in one sect or another. Our country is not immune from this development. Hence, the CERN thought it is apt to dedicate this year's annual lecture to cults, sects, and religious movements. What are they doing to contemporary society? So it has nothing to do with the Halloween night. It is my pleasure tonight to introduce Professor Emeritus Eileen Barker of the London School of Economics, who is a foremost world scholar on this topic and an authority. No wonder she is consulted by bishops, governments, and even the police. I am sure that you will enjoy hearing about her research on these new religious movements. Professor Barker.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very great pleasure and honor to be here this evening. I think the last time I was on a stage in Malta was 1959, and things have changed. I've changed, and so have you. Well, some of you weren't born, probably most of you weren't. Anyway, it's really wonderful to be here, and I am so honored to have been invited to speak to you on this enormous subject. I've been studying new religions for over 30 years now, and there's just so much one can say. So I hope that you will ask me in questions some of the things that I don't say, because I can't possibly cover everything. I mean, just imagine if you were asked to talk about Catholicism. Now, I run an organization called Inform, and that's supported by the government and the mainstream churches and the Metropolitan Police. And we have over 3,000 different groups on our files. So it really is an enormous subject. And so Catholicism, just talking about Catholicism, would be quite easy. People don't really have a very clear idea about what is meant by new religious movements or cults or sects, as they are frequently referred to nowadays. Mostly people think of some of the awful tragedies that there have been when the word cult is mentioned. The first one to really hit the headlines was when the People's Temple in Guyana incident occurred, Thanksgiving 1978, when Congressman Ryan was murdered and over 900 people, members of the People's Temple who belonged committed suicide or were murdered. 200 of them were children who were murdered, and several other people were murdered trying to escape or had poison injected into them. Then there was the Branch Davidians at Waco, which again hit the headlines. There was a long, month-long siege. The FBI eventually went in, and a large number of individuals and children again were murdered. This was a real tragedy. It didn't have to have happened. The FBI now realize that it was a tragedy and an unnecessary tragedy. But the hype around the idea of cult was so great that things just got out of hand and this tragedy occurred. The Solar Temple cases were the first time that we had problems in Europe. It started in Canada, but then France and Switzerland, there were suicides and assisted suicides, in other words, murders that took place there. Om Shinrikyo was the first time that we really were worried about terrorism. That was the incident in the Tokyo underground when sarin gas was let off and several people died. There were some other murders as well. And that was when biological warfare and the dangers that a very few people could pose to society were stressed. The movement for the restoration of the Ten Commandments of God, you may remember in 2000, that was in Uganda, but it's interesting because this was the first Catholic-based or Catholic-related movement to have such a tragedy. And then, of course, there's 9/11, which one could say has changed the world and made such a big difference to the way that religions look at each other and the way in which political problems are defined now in religious terms quite often. What is a cult? Well, sociologists define cults and sects in opposition to churches and denomination, seeing them as movements which are in tension with society. And we see this in a fairly neutral kind of way, but if one talks about a cult in the popular media or elsewhere, the answer tends to be that it is a dangerous pseudo-religion with satanic overtones which is involved in financial rackets and political intrigue, indulges in unnatural sexual practices, abuses its women and children, and uses irresistible and irreversible brainwashing techniques to exploit its recruits. It frequently resorts to violence, performs numerous criminal activities, and is likely to commit mass suicide. That, of course, is in opposition to religion, which is good and godly. Well, such a distinction is obviously not very helpful. What we have to do is look and see whether a particular cult or new religious movement, as academics prefer to call them, does actually get involved in political intrigue, in violence or child abuse or whatever it is. One of the accusations that is made most frequently is that cults brainwash, recruit their converts. It isn't done through free will. And in the 1970s, there was a great deal of accusation of brainwashing because people couldn't understand, particularly anxious parents, why their children, adult children, would suddenly leave home, leave university, leave good jobs, and go and work in some sort of new religious movement, which was completely opposed to the sorts of values and beliefs that they had been brought up in, or so their parents thought. As a result, we had what was known as deprogramming, where people were kidnapped. Their parents would pay thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of pounds, to rescue them from the dangerous cult into which they had been brainwashed. And they would be held illegally against their will until they renounced their faith or managed to escape. In the 70s, I was very worried by this state of affairs, and I did a study on the Unification Church, which was the one that was most frequently in the papers and accused of being a brainwashing cult, and out of which a large number of people in America and Europe and in Japan and other places were being kidnapped and held for deprogramming. What is brainwashing? Well, obviously it's a metaphor. You don't take somebody's brain apart and wash it with DAZ or Persil or something. What does it really mean? The next question is it actually the process or the end result, the content, which is worrying people? Do you use brainwash or menticide, mind control, or all these other words for something that would be called conversion or socialization or even education if the end results were different? What is going on? One of the things that was said was that people would go along to Unification or Mooney, as they were called, Mooney workshops, which were residential, and something would happen to them. They would enter and they would end up the end of the machine as a Mooney. And this was irresistible and irreversible, and it could happen to anyone that the Moonies got into their clutches. What I found, however, when I looked at over a thousand people who went to these workshops, is that 90% of them didn't join the Unification Church. They were perfectly capable of saying, no thanks, we don't want to be. And interestingly enough, among those who went, who agreed, who were interested enough to go, were a large number of lapsed Catholics. And what I found was that the Catholics were unlikely to join, but were quite likely to say, the weekend inspired me, raised my spiritual awareness, made me realize what I was missing, so I went back to the church. I've told some of my priest friends that if they want to get their lapsed flock back, then perhaps they should send them to Mooney workshops. But I don't think any of them have followed that advice. Furthermore, the majority of those who did join left of their own free will within a couple of years. And I also found that it wasn't the very pathetic or suggestible people who joined the Unification Church. They were individuals who felt that what the church seemed to be offering was something very positive. It gave them a chance to lead a life of devotion, they felt, and to help bring the kingdom of heaven on earth. And in many ways, I found that they were joined not in spite of their parents' beliefs and values, but because of them. They came, on the whole, from families, good families, that instilled values of caring and helping and responsibility. But these young people thought that the traditional churches were hypocritical, apathetic, and they wanted to do something. They wanted to be somebody and help God, live for God, and they thought the Unification Church would allow them to do this. But many of them found that they were disappointed, and so they returned to their own religions or moved on somewhere else after a shortish period of time. Now I am studying the children of the people that I interviewed in the 70s, and about 90% of the first cohort of the second generation have left. Now the second cohort seemed to be more likely to stay in for a number of reasons I haven't got to go into at the moment. But obviously, if the Unification Church is brainwashing, it's doing it extremely inefficiently. And most traditional churches manage to keep their flock far more successfully than they do. And this sort of study has been repeated with many of the new religions, cults, sects. There tends to be a very high turnover, and very few of them retain members, or indeed get members, beyond a certain limit. There are always exceptions, of course. And as Father Joe told us, new religions have been around for ages, and all the traditional religions were new religions at some point. Now, what's going on in the world at the moment? Since the Second World War, well, since the last century, really, there's been a lot of talk about secularization that's tied up with modernization, industrialization, bureaucratization, all the isations, leading to, it was argued, a gradual or not so gradual diminution of religiosity. This has occurred in a number of ways in a lot of countries, but it isn't the whole story. There have been a lot of changes going on, and secularization is only one aspect. I think globalization and the ensuing pluralism are very important, and we need to be far more aware of the enormous variety of things that are happening. There's been for some time growth in the values of individualism and choice. In the old days, there was pluralism and diversity, but on the whole, you tended to belong to the religion that the lord or the king belonged to. It wasn't individual choice, it was a sort of group belonging. People did convert, but generally speaking, individuals didn't do that. And if the king changed from Catholic to Protestant or the other way around, then all his or her subjects were expected to as well. Authority has changed quite dramatically in a number of spheres in society. Families changed. You no longer have the patriarchal family that you used to have in either America or Europe, and it's changing in other places around the world in a number of ways that you're very familiar with. Education has changed from rote learning and accepting authority to more exploratory, self-thinking kinds of pedagogical ideas. The establishment is no longer revered in the way that it used to be, and the churches are not getting the respect that they used to have in society. There has been an enormous amount of mobility over recent years. There's geographical mobility with immigration, people going on holidays, seeing the world. And with immigration, you might find you're in a classroom or working with a whole lot of different people of different faiths, so that your faith is no longer as likely to be taken for granted. It may strengthen it if you have to defend it, but it is relativized in some way. There's more awareness that there are other ways of answering the questions of ultimate concern that have been addressed for years by religions. There's also a lot of social mobility. Few of us any longer have the occupations that our grandparents had, and our grandchildren are unlikely to have the occupations we have. So just as we don't live in the village where our grandparents lived, we don't have the same jobs and we don't have the same experience of life. So what made sense to our grandparents is unlikely to make sense to our grandchildren, at least if it's presented in the same way as it was in the grandparents' time. The mass media have caused an enormous amount of both supply and demand of alternative ideas. We now know, not in any depth probably, but at least superficially, of all sorts of different answers to the ultimate questions, all sorts of different ways of living, different lifestyles, different attitudes and everything. And of course, this has been going on for ages. I mean, the printing of the Bible made an enormous difference all that time ago. But more recently, radio, telephones, satellite television, beaming televangelists around the world, and most recently, of course, the World Wide Web, have all made enormous differences to our desire to find and explore alternative ways of believing and belonging, and the supply that is out there. We have access to all these resources which weren't so readily available. They were there, but not so very readily available in the past. Now, this is my sort of plan that I kind of work with in my mind about what's going on in religion today. The top part is the secularism bit. Hard secularism is atheism or humanism. This is positively anti, if you understand what I mean. They are saying this, there is not a God. Up at the top, this is what I'm calling apathetic secularism. This is probably real secularism. It's people not thinking about it. It's God or the supernatural is not part of their lives. They have other interests. It's just not something that enters into everyday ideas. And you find a lot of this in Britain, actually. But you also find a lot of what I call soft secularism. This takes a variety of forms, but it's the sort of lapsed secularism. They very often believe but don't belong to any organization, but they believe in a sort of absent-minded way or at times of crisis. They want the churches or the traditional religions to be there in the background if needed or as part of society. They're not anti in the way that the hard secularism is. And they think religion is a good thing rather than not thinking about it at all. They'll go through the rituals of birth, marriage and death, baptism, not confirmation so likely. But it's, you could almost call it a soft religiosity. The traditional religions are, of course, still very important, and most people probably belong to a traditional religion, whether they do it formally or not, throughout the world. Even in the more secular societies, there is some sort of allegiance. And I'm not going to be talking about the traditional religions, but I do want to stress that they are part of the scene, and indeed they are part of the cult or the new religious movement scene, because all these arrows indicate there is a going in and a coming out that's happening the whole time, with new religions being part of this shifting scene that's going on. And within the traditional religions, you will find sectarian groups emerging and sometimes being excluded or excluding themselves, but sometimes quite happily sitting within the traditional church. This happens in all the religions. The main church reacts in different ways. Catholics tend to be more embracing than Protestants, which are more likely to have sectarian schisms. And it happens slightly less in Orthodox, but I haven't got time to go into that. But there are a lot of new religious movements, in inverted commas, associated with the Roman Catholic Church, for example. Some people have thought of Opus Dei in these terms, the neo-catechumenate way, Focolare, Communio Liberazione, Legionaries of Christ, or Regnum Christi, the Society of St. Pius X, the Apostles of Infinite Love. You may not have heard about that. It's in near Montreal, and I went and visited Pope Gregory XVII, a delightful man, just before he went to prison for abusing young persons. Another Pope, Gregory XVII, in the Palmarian Church. The Magnificat Meal Movement, that's in Australia, and run by this woman called Deborah. I visited her. Not part of the main Catholic Church. But that's just an example, and I'm sure you can think of more. I'm not saying they are in or out. Some of them obviously were in, some of them are on the margins, and some of them are out. But I just want to stress there's this shift going on, and you can't separate everything out. Now, if we look down at the bottom part, the new religious movements are part of two sort of prongs that are depictable with fundamentalism on the one hand and spirituality on the other. But two dimensions isn't enough. We need about 50 dimensions. And the new religious movements sort of slither in and out along that continuum, as well as popping in and out of the traditional religions. Fundamentalism is sometimes thought of as a hybrid between a new religious movement and traditional or conservative orthodox religion. It claims to have the pure right doctrines and practices. And it's been defined by Martin Marty and Scott Appleby in their magnificent study of fundamentalism at the University of Chicago as a process of selective retrieval, embellishment, and construction of essentials or fundamentals of a religious tradition for the purposes of halting the erosion of traditional encroachments of secular modernity. So they put in the motivation, they're spreading it beyond the turn of the 19th, 20th century fundamentalism, Protestant fundamentalism that we found in America, which is what was the sort of historical start of this concept. They have certain ideological characteristics. I've already mentioned the reaction to the marginalization of religion. They select, they say they're going back to the pure beliefs and taking from the tradition, the pristine purity. They select from modernity as well, both positively and negatively. A lot of modernity is selected as being wicked, evil, satanic, etc. But they will also use modernity, electronic means of communication, videos, and unfortunately sometimes guns. Moral Manichaeism, they tend to be very dualistic in their outlook with the belief that light will eventually triumph. Belief in absolutism and inerrancy as opposed to modern hermeneutics. And quite often there are millennial or messianic aspects to the beliefs. Then there are certain organizational characteristics to this more fundamentalist end of the continuum. They believe they are an elect, chosen membership. There are sharp boundaries drawn between them and us, authoritarian organization, and there are certain behavioral requirements that are expected of you so that you're committed in a number of different ways and are expected to follow certain rules of behavior as well as following certain beliefs. Now, if we skip over to the other side of this continuum, to what I'm calling spirituality. I'm not going to go through this in detail, but there is a possibility of drawing two sort of cartoon type, but what sociologists call ideal types, of opposites on the continuum, where you're more likely to have certain beliefs and patterns going together on one side, or certain bundles of characteristics on the other side. So the religiosity side of the continuum is likely to see God in terms of a transcendent God, a personal God, who is beyond oneself, maybe internal as well, but the spirituality is more concerned with the immanent or the cosmic, and talks about the God within. Time is seen in religiosity as having creation, a now, and then there's an eschatology, an end time, whereas spirituality is seen in more ahistorical, cyclical ways. And there are a whole lot of other characteristics. Just to pop down to the end, life after death is seen in the religiosity of the book. And I'm saying of the book because if you go to Hinduism or Buddhism, obviously you're wandering more towards the spirituality side and a lot of these characteristics. But salvation and resurrection as opposed to reincarnation, which is popular on the spirituality side. If you want in questions, I can come back to this more. Now, I'm not saying you ever find anybody who's exactly one or the other, but it's just a sort of allow us to make comparisons when we're looking at the new religions and see how they wander and spread themselves out in all these different ways. So not only do they do that theologically, if we could put it like that, but they also differ in a number of other ways. The one thing that one can say about new religions is that you cannot generalize about them. I used to say to my students, if you can find one generalization about new religions, cults, and sects, apart from the fact that they've been called a new religion, cult, or sect, that all of them have, I will give you a box of Smarties. I don't know if you have Smarties in Malta. Do you have Smarties?
Yes, do.
You do? Okay, you know. Well, I never had to give them a box of Smarties for that. I used to give them Smarties for other things. Bribery works well. But never for that. There is always some exception, and I could usually find one for whatever they came up with. They differ according to their beliefs. They come from the different traditions, the Judeo-Christian, Islamic traditions, Buddhism, Shinto, Zoroastrianism, and you get a whole lot of new ones like UFO cults, where people are in touch with other planets, ascended masters are channeled through. Some are tied up with Freudian or psychological ideals. And now we have a whole lot of virtual new religions, which you can find on the web. I mean, some of them are very extraordinary. If you have some spare time and an insatiable curiosity as to the limits to which people can expand their imagination, go on the web and look at some of these new virtual religions. Some of them, as we've seen, can be pretty nasty, but not all of them. And most of them lead perfectly ordinary lives as far as behaving goes. There's no criminal activity or other behavior that's typical of new religious movements and atypical of old religious movements. It spreads right across all the ages of religions. There are possibly more saints and sinners in new religions because they tend to be more sharply focused for doing good or doing evil. But there is nothing particular about them. Each movement has to be looked at according to what it does at a particular time and at a particular place. So a movement in Malta will be very different from one in Vietnam, the same movement, if it's not underground in Vietnam, say. And at different times, it will be different. I find it helpful when talking to people to distinguish between the movement itself, its beliefs and practices, the leadership, and the grassroots members. I mean, personally, I often find the leader a rather repulsive person, and I am unattracted by the movement, but I find the members delightful, sincere, good people. Now, that's a bit simplistic, and that's just me being personal, not being a sociologist. But I do think it's helpful to make that distinction. Now, having said that you can't generalize, I am a sociologist, so I'm going to generalize, and suggest some of the characteristics of new religious movements that we can recognize some of the time, but let me stress, there are qualifications to everything I'm going to say now. First of all, by definition, I'm talking about first-generation membership. Now, sometimes people include 19th century sects that appeared sometime during the 19th century or even before. I'm thinking about Jehovah's Witnesses, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, Christadelphians, Salvation Army, and some other groups, the Baha'i perhaps. I'm not talking about them now. I might be talking about them when they were new religions, but I'm talking about ones that are first-generation members that I and my colleagues have been studying that have become visible on the whole since the Second World War. And this means that they are converts. Now, I don't know if you know about converts or you're one yourself, but they do tend to be far more enthusiastic and certain that they know the truth than the rest of us. My brother converted to Catholicism and he was impossible for at least 3 months. We were all miserable Protestants or sinners. he sort of got over it. I don't mean the Catholicism, he got over being so impossible. But converts do know that they know, and they can be a pain when they want you, they want to share desperately with you their knowledge. They tend also to be atypical of the population. They appeal to certain people but not to others, so you don't get a normal distribution. Take, for example, the age distribution of the Children of God. They're now known as the Family International. It was part of the Jesus movement in the 1960s. If you look at the age distribution, they were nearly all around the age of 23. That was the average age. There were very few children and very few older people. This means they hadn't got responsibilities. They could go off all over the place to get other people to take Jesus into their hearts. They were inexperienced. They kept being over-enthusiastic. And they were rushing around. Just looking at that particular demographic fact can explain quite a lot of how a new religious movement behaves. Not everything, they're all different, and not all of them appeal just to young people. In the past, new religious movements have tended to appeal to the oppressed, the socially or politically oppressed. The current wave of new religions haven't. They have appealed more to white, middle-class, well-educated young people. There are numbers of reasons for this, but again, the Rastafarians appeal to young black males, so there are lots of differences, and now there are sort of older ones, but just if you recognize the atypicalness, this can make it, explain quite a bit. Another characteristic is that very often the founder is considered a charismatic leader. That means he, or occasionally she, is thought by his or her followers to have some special powers, some grace, some access, hotline to God, or may even be God. And therefore, the person is given the right by the followers, and it's an exchange. The followers say, okay, you have the right to have control, tell me what to do about all aspects of my life. Now, you might think the Pope says quite a bit about how you should lead your lives, but that's nothing compared to the charismatic leader in a new religious movement, who can say who you'll marry, how many children you'll have, whether you'll have children, where you'll live, what work you'll do, perhaps even whether you'll live. And they are unbound by rules or by tradition, and this means that they are unaccountable to anyone except perhaps to God, and unpredictable. It tends also to be a top-down hierarchical authority established fairly quickly, and the communication structure tends to be from above down, so that there isn't horizontal communication, and quite often there is separation even of couples by a variety of different means, so that you don't have people talking and checking out, or at least that is controlled to quite a large extent. There tends to be a dichotomous worldview. Things are seen sharp boundaries between them on a number of dimensions. Theologically, there's the godly versus the satanic, the light versus the dark, morally good versus bad, right versus wrong. There's the before I converted when I was a miserable sinner, and there's the now. There's the expected apocalypse, perhaps, or the new age that is dawning. But it's sort of not, and obviously I'm more at the fundamentalist end now than the spiritualist or new agey kind of end. And then the social distinction between them and us tends to be fairly sharply drawn. And us, we are seen as homogeneously godly and good, whereas them are seen as pretty satanic and evil. Now, this has happened in new religions throughout history, and what I'm saying doesn't just apply to the contemporary new religion. And there's a good reason for these sharp boundaries, because you've got converts who are being told by parents and the rest of society, you're wrong. why don't you stay like you have been brought up? There needs to be protection. And it can be more or less. But Jesus is reported in Luke as saying, if any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. Now, he also stresses the commandment that you should honor your father and mother. But there is this cutting off that you find over and over again. Buddha said, a man who wishes to become my disciple must be willing to give up all direct relations with his family. And, family, the social life of the world, and dependence upon wealth. So this cutting off is nothing new. It's something that's been happening in new religions throughout history. Then another thing, which is not surprising, considering that new religions are offering an alternative, is that they are treated with suspicion and antagonism from non-members. Now, the new religions are going out. They have an interest in telling everybody how wonderful they are, that they have the truth. So their images of themselves will be to take all what they consider to be the good things and leave out any skeletons that are in the cupboard. But quite often you get the growth of what's called generically the anti-cult movement. And they want to control or ban the new religions. And this can extend to certain governments, to certain churches, and various areas of society. A lot of anti-cult movements were started off by worried parents. And they tend in their images to select all the bad actions and leave out anything that's good or normal. And sometimes they seem to have a sort of mirror image of their representation of the new religions in seeing them as homogeneously bad and evil and satanic. Then you've got what are sometimes referred to as the counter-cult movement. These are concerned about the theology rather than the actions, and they want to say, we have the real truth. So they will point to the wrong beliefs and don't point to or talk about the shared beliefs. And sometimes they too, when they get pretty strong, can provide a mirror image of the cult that they are describing. And you've got the media, and they of course want a good story, and a good story is a bad story, and so they will always write something that's shocking or exotic and aren't likely to tell you about the more ordinary or everyday aspects of the movement. Now, social scientists try not to select in and out in that way, but we do select in a slightly different way. We have a number of techniques for studying the movements. We might go and live with them for a time and observe them. We can interview them on random sampling basis so that everybody has an equal chance of being interviewed. We can give them questionnaires and have a control group so that we can see how they differ from other people. We can read all sorts of literature and various other things. And we select out the theology in the sense that although we can describe the new religion's theologies, we don't assess their beliefs at the theological level. We try and keep to the empirical level because we have no particular techniques to assess the theology. As sociologists, we can, of course, as citizens. And the same goes for values. At Inform, we're continually asked if a religion is bad or good. And we say, well, what do you mean by bad, or what do you mean by a cult if we're asked if they're a cult? Now, this can obviously be a bit silly, but what we try to do is say, well, if you think sleeping around is bad, then such and such a group is a bad group, or whatever it is. But we hand over to the people the right to have their own values. I once had a man who phoned me up. He said he was very worried about his son because his son had stopped sleeping around, had come off drugs and cut his hair, and so obviously he must be brainwashed. And definitions. We try not to label and just say, as in that rather ridiculous example I gave you at the beginning, by putting the label cult on a new religious movement, it has all those overtones of awful things the matter with them. But we do try and select in a wide range of perspectives, talking to members, past members, parents of members, and anybody else that we can get hold of. Statistics, try and find out frequency, how many people who join the Hare Krishna used to be Catholics and are female, etc., and do a lot of analysis that way. The use of comparison I've just mentioned, this is really very important, because if you see a headline, which you're quite likely to do, saying cult member commits suicide, you're likely to think, oh, that's terrible. And then if you see it, say, three times that a cult member had committed suicide, you think, well, what is it about the cult that makes people commit suicide? But you never see a headline saying Catholic commits suicide. It's just not good news. I mean, it might be if it was a bishop, but an ordinary Catholic, it won't be mentioned. So what we try to do is see what the rate of suicide would be in the cult and in the normal population of a similar size, similar background and socioeconomic status, etc. And it may well be that that is higher than the suicide rate in the cult. And then the question becomes, well, what might it be about the religious movement that stops them committing suicide? And I've certainly talked to a large number of members, well, a considerable number of members, who've said that they would have committed suicide if they hadn't found their new religion. Whether they would have done or not is beside the point. The point I'm trying to make is that at least the question is asked to try and sort out what is typical of one group and not so much on another. We look at processes and structures and change. And change really is important, characteristic of new religions. They change far more rapidly than old religious movements do. And that's pretty obvious if you think of some of the characteristics that I've been mentioning. They will change because of internal beliefs. I mean, if, for example, they expected the world to come to an end on Thursday, they've got to have some sort of explanation by Friday breakfast. There are the inevitable demographic changes. You remember the Children of God, average age 23 in the 70s. 90s, average age 23, but a very different profile. They've got masses of children, and they have got older themselves and more mature. Now, this makes an enormous difference, and I can't go into it because I haven't got time, but if you just think about it, you will see that this is very important. Charismatic leaders tend to die. Some of them say they're not going to, but they do tend to die. And when they die, very often you will get more bureaucratization. Traditions come along. They become more predictable, more accountable. So that's another important change. And gradually the sharp them-us boundaries get broken down as perhaps they start to use the grandparents when children come along. They'll go out to work, whereas before they were just working for the movement. They might join the PTA, the Parent Teacher Association. They might go and play tennis at a club. They'll have crisscrossing connections like most of us do who are not members of a close-knit cult. Externally, pressure that can lead to what is sometimes called deviance amplification. Waco would be an example of this. The FBI and David Koresh sort of got further and further away until eventually the tragedy occurred. Each side behaves slightly worse and gives permission to the other side to behave badly. Or you can get accommodation where they come closer to society and react in a positive way, possibly because of outside pressure. I mean, sometimes court cases have resulted in movements changing, or they will change for PR reasons, perhaps, but that doesn't matter, in a sense, because they start to behave in a more acceptable way. And then you get social change in the society, which has got nothing to do with the new religions, but which affects them quite strongly. When the Berlin Wall fell down in 1989, masses of them rushed into Eastern Europe. The introduction of the World Wide Web has made quite an important difference, and it can work in a number of ways. In some ways, in controlling the groups, within the groups, but also it can undermine the horizontal communication can start through email, and even cutting across the boundary of membership and non-membership, so that you get this horizontal instead of just vertical communication, and this undermines the authority of the leadership quite strongly. Okay, there are lots of ways, to repeat, where we have new religious movements being affected by and affecting individuals and societies. The legal structure in many societies has been changed. Politics have been changed because of new religions. Attitudes have been changed in a large number of ways, sometimes for better and sometimes for worse. In 1986, I was invited by the Polish government. This was still during the Soviet period, but Glasnost and Perestroika had come in. I was invited by the Polish government to give some lectures in Poland. And I gave one in Warsaw on diversity and pluralism in North America and Western Europe. And at the end of it, somebody put up their hand and said, well, this is all very interesting, but who's going to win? Now, this really blew me. I hadn't considered that as a question to address. But since that period, I've been doing a lot of work in Eastern Europe, and I've been places like China, and a few weeks ago I was in Vietnam. And it is an important question, because people are saying, are we going to win? And it has become a reality far more, so that the diversity is not always peaceful coexistence. Everybody is pushing. Now, there are some religions, some new religions, some old religions, that celebrate diversity, but there are others that don't, that are asking who's going to win. And my personal opinion, which I believe is backed by history and anthropology and sociology, is that if any one religion or group wins, then I think perhaps we will all lose. Thank you.
And now Professor Barker will be taking 15 minutes of questions. I ask the questioners please to identify themselves before putting the question.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Hello again. Giving all this information about new religious movements and cults, etc., and what we have, can I first ask you, what is your opinion about, is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? Because the world has been changing all the time in history, and we can see when...
Sorry, is what a good thing?
The new religious movements, cults and that. And the other question is, we've always had change through history when St. Francis of Assisi broke away from the main church and started his own spiritual or religious movement. And, of course, looking back at St. Francis, we can say it's a good thing, you know, because he taught spiritual values and, in a sense, he took a look at himself and he analyzed himself in his own personal relationship with God. And the thing that I'm thinking of is actually that my concept and view about the whole thing, why the world is changing in such a drastic way, is because I think people are looking at themselves internally and discovering, you know, what is my role in life, and looking at the internal values and saying, you know, well, why am I here? Why do I exist?
Right. I think that was probably a statement rather than a question, but you ask whether it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, the first one.
Why I said it, what did you mean by it, is that I can't answer that question because some is good, some is bad. So, you've got to look at each religion. I mean, there are some very bad things in the Church of England. Not very, very bad, but there have been awful things done by religions and wonderful things done. There are some very not... I'm not going to defend what Ashihara did in the Tokyo Underground. Mm-hmm. That's obviously bad. But other religions are doing a whole lot of good work. I was recently in South Africa, and I went into the black townships with two different new religious movements. They were doing wonderful work on adult literacy and AIDS, HIV. Some of them, you were talking about seeking and looking and trying to find something. Yes, and you know, if they do find something that doesn't harm anybody, then okay. St. Francis, well, his dad wasn't very pleased, as I remember, when he started off behaving like he did. But obviously, all of us think of him as a fantastic saint.
Right.
But beyond saying, don't generalize, we can't generalize, we ought to look at each group, at each individual almost, whether it's, because some things are good for some people and bad for others, or good at one point in their lives and bad in another point. And with my example of the man who phoned up about his son who stopped sleeping around and taking drugs, I mean, I would have been delighted if it had been my son, but I couldn't understand why he was worried, because he'd been trying for so long that he thought it must be something sinister.
Okay, thank you. Oh, and one last other thing. My name is Edward Milan, and actually I am a Mooney, and I remember that you interviewed me in London about 25 years ago.
What's your name?
Edward Milan.
I'm ashamed to say I don't remember. It's one of those awful eight-hour interviews. Thank you very much for putting up with me.
Thank you.
Will I get a smarty if I suggest that cult, sect, and RMs somehow represent a protest?
Yes.
And a protest against society. I get a smarty. Good.
What was your last sentence?
If each of them represent some kind of a protest.
Yes.
Against society.
Yes. Yes, I think they usually do, and they will protest in different ways. So some will go out with guns, some will go out on the street, but some withdraw, and their protest is to withdraw. And I know you know Roy Wallace's distinctions that he makes between world-affirming, world-accommodating, and world... What's the third one? Well, whatever the third one is, the protesting. Rejecting. World rejecting religions. But it's a protest in that they're offering something different. They don't have to be a very hard protest, going out demonstrating, but they are saying what exists is not adequate. So we're offering something different. A protest against religion? No. Oh, no. Yes. It can be against society. It can be political. There are left-wing groups like Ananda Marga or the Children of God. Right-wing, the Unification Church has been, but it's a sort of theocratic communism as well. There are a whole lot of different kinds of protests. There's no one single type. Yep.
Hello. My name is Michael Zamit, and my background is philosophy. What strikes me about your presentation is that What you said here seems to correspond very clearly with the beginning of, for example, Christianity. All that you've said here was right there at the beginning. So the question still remains, what are they doing in contemporary Western society, these new religious movements? Are they perhaps looking for alternatives to the traditional? And why are they doing that? What has happened to the traditional? And why have people gone back to this, to all this? Because, again, I repeat, all that you've said was right there at the beginning of Christianity.
Yes. My point was, these are characteristics that one can expect quite often of new religions, new religions. And certainly, I think all the new religions have at least some aspects of that. And as I said just now, I agreed it is partly a protest because what is there is not seen as adequate. Religiously, politically, socially, it might be a feminist change. Or it might be that somebody feels that they have had some sort of religious experience. A large number of people do have religious experiences, and what several of the new religions do is interpret those experiences so that it proves to the person who's had it that they should join this particular group. The interpretation and the experience should be separated out because they can work in a number of different ways. Sometimes experiences are invoked. For example, in one group, Sahaja Yoga, you're asked to put your hands up, and then you'll feel a cool breeze. Try it. Put your hands up. See if you feel a cool breeze. Okay, put your hands down if you feel a cool breeze. Right. Well, those of you who have felt the cool breeze, I sent it to you. It was my love for you. So please follow me now.
At the end of your very interesting seminar, you made a statement: if one religion wins, then we shall all lose. Yet at the end, there was a question mark. Was it a question? Would you like to attempt an answer?
I think if any one religion says, I have the whole truth, absolute truth, there is absolutely nothing that can be questioned, you will all follow me and obey, and you cannot think for yourselves, that is a loss for us. Now, obviously, some religions winning would be better than other religions winning, but I am suggesting that having variety, having choice, is a good thing, but there is always the problem that if we say that, and it's the basic problem of liberalism, what about the nasties? How liberal can we be about the nasties? It was mentioned that I work with the police and I work with the FBI but mainly in Britain with Metropolitan Police. And as soon as I hear of anything that's criminal, I report it to the police for them to investigate. And I think, criminal codes should control up to a point as far as we can. I mean, there are things to be done about nasties. I'm being a bit elliptical, but I do believe that man has not yet convinced me that God speaks all that clearly. You've taken me a bit back. I mean, in one sense, it's very obvious to me that a religion is man's expression of trying to get to God. And man has, and mainly men, sometimes women, has messed that up so often. I think we need to have alternatives available, which is a sort of democracy, which I could argue against. But have I argued enough for my... I don't want to say... I wanted to leave it with the question mark so that you would think, would you be entirely happy if your religion were the only thing there? In one sense, yes, of course. But really, are you so sure that the interpreters of your religion are always right, and that perhaps just a bit of pressure from elsewhere might not be a good thing?
Thank you very much, Professor Barker. I'm sure that we all feel at least more enlightened about the possible impacts of the NRMs on contemporary society. For the last century, at least, to use the inner word, we have branded our country with the eight-pointed cross of the Knights of Malta. However, the times and the methods used by the Knights against non-Christians are over, and perhaps relegated to the dustbin of history. We are a modern society now, which accepts not only religious tolerance, but it accepts religious freedom and freedom of conscience. Given this scenario, I think our church should look at its pastoral ministry, especially in relation to this new phenomenon. And I think our thought should be more polished and more sophisticated in the best term of the word. I do not have evidently a ready-made and a cookbook recipe of how we should go about doing this. However, one way to do it is surely study and reflection of these phenomena. Especially suspicion based on prejudice, is a shortcut to ostracism. And ostracization is a block to evangelization. So it should never be our method. I thank you again, Professor Barker, for giving us this nice lecture, which I should say it was also entertaining in its presentation. Thank you very much.
Campus FM has just presented a lecture by the CERN, the Institute for Research on the Signs of the Times. Cults, sects, and new religious movements. What are they doing in contemporary Western society? This lecture was delivered by Professor Eileen Barker.